My name's John Mott. I'm the project coordinator for Chemo International, and I'd like to talk to you about the transport of mixed oxide fuel and radioactive cargoes by ship in Europe. Before I start, I'll just explain a little bit about Chemo International and what we do. We're an association of 116 coastal local municipalities around the North Sea and the Northeast Atlantic, and we focus on marine pollution, covering a range of issues, including maritime safety, marine litter, decommissioning of the oil industry, and, of course, nuclear issues. Obviously, all our members are very concerned about the transport of MOX fuel and radioactive wastes by sea. They all have coastlines, and they all rely on the pristine environment, either through tourism or fisheries, for their economic wealth, and, more importantly, on the perception of a clean environment. And any sort of accident involving radioactive material would be devastating for these communities. So if I could just run you through what I'm going to cover today. Firstly, the increase of shipments within Europe recently, the quality of the ships being used to transport MOX fuel, the quality of the shipping flasks, the potential terrorist threat, and I'll run through a scenario with you, military escorts, and finally some contingency planning, or lack of contingency planning, I should say. These are just some of the recent shipments that have been through Europe. There have been two shipments, one in June 2005 and one in November last year, both from Sellafield to Cherbourg and then on to Switzerland for NOK. This was both mock shipments with a total of 170 kilograms of plutonium on board. And as we've heard, there's been the proposal for shipments of 850 kilograms of plutonium as mocks from Sellafield to Oskarshamn here in Sweden. Now, you would think that being in Europe that these shipments would be taken in the highest possible quality ships, at least equal to those that ship MOX fuel to Japan. But of course, we're talking about the nuclear industry, so maybe I shouldn't be too optimistic. If we look at what the Office of Civil Nuclear Security in the UK says, it says, although there's differences between the shipments to Japan and the shipments within Europe, there are no differences in the standard they require BNFL to maintain. However, when we come to look at the vessels, and this is the Atlantic Osprey, the vessel that has been used to transport the MOX to Switzerland. This is a 23-year-old ex-roll-on, roll-off cargo ferry, which was only bought by BNFL in 2001. It's already had one engine room fire which disabled the ship while in their own ship and is now owned by the new Nuclear Decommissioning Agency. If we compare this to the vessels that are used to transport MOX to Japan, this is the Pacific Pintail, which is a purpose-built carrier for carrying MOX fuel and designed specifically for that purpose. If I can just do a little comparison between the two vessels, obviously the Pintail, purpose-built ship, the Ospar, is an ex-ferry. The Pacific Pintail has a specially built double hull. The Atlantic Osprey has a single hull. The Pintail has two complete separate propulsion systems, including engines, drive shafts, propellers. The Osprey has a single engine and has already had one engine room fire in its life. The Pacific Pintail has dual controls, which means dual controls on the bridge, the electrics, the wiring, the radar, two rudders. If one system fails, it can still operate on the other system. The Osprey only has one control system. The Pintail, if they have a fire or an attack on board, they can flood the hold containing the canisters of MOX. The Osprey doesn't have this facility. The Pintail carries a 100-ton flask. The Osprey carries a 5-ton road flask. The Pintail has been designed to withstand a 90-degree collision with a 24,000-ton vessel at 15 knots and withstand it. The Osprey is not designed to withstand any collisions. The Pintail is escorted by its sister ship, the Pacific Teal, for the whole length of its voyage to provide cover if either one is attacked. The Atlantic Osprey will be travelling unescorted through Europe. The Pintail and the Teal both have naval cannons on board as well as armed officers on the ships. The Osprey only has armed officers. And the Pintail is the highest quality ship, an IFN3 class ship, whereas the Osprey is IFN2. So I think you can see there's a quite clear difference between the ships here. It's also been suggested that the MV Signan, the Swedish ship, could be used. And although it does have some advantages over the Osprey, such as two engines and a double hull, it is still not up to the standard of the Pacific Pintail. And before you think that I'm suggesting that the Pintail is the ultimate, it is not the ultimate. And there are still problems. Janes, which is an expert in naval and military matters, have said that the two ships, although they've got naval guns, could still be easily overwhelmed by a coordinated action by pirates or terrorists. And we've discovered through discussions with BNFL that you can only flood the hold manually from the deck. So if you're in the middle of a terrorist attack, how are you going to get out on deck to manually flood the cargo hold? So this is the type of flask we're talking about that's on board the vessels for transporting Demox shipments. These are classified as Type B flasks, and there are a set requirement for Type B flasks so they can withstand an accident. A drop test from 9 metres onto a hard surface, a puncture test, an immersion test at a depth of 15 metres for 8 hours. But I think you can imagine that if there was an accident, it's going to be down there for more than 8 hours, that's for sure. There's a fire test at 800 degrees C for 30 minutes, and I'll come back to that. But as far as we know, there's been no tests to see what the effect of freezing temperatures are on these flasks, which is, of course, of interest in the Baltic, where it freezes over during the winter. If we look at vessel fires, it's been proven that fires last a little longer than 30 minutes on board vessels, and certainly there's been cases where temperatures of up to 1,300 degrees have been recorded rather than the 800. So how you can guarantee the safety of a flask with only doing the test for at 800 degrees for 30 minutes is beyond me. The World Nuclear Transport Institute did a study into sea accidents, and they concluded that the risk was very small, and that was for all types of waste. However, I'm not sure if they were taking into consideration the post 9/11 reality where we have to live with the threat of a terrorist attack. Now, some of you might be aware of this vessel. This is the SS Cole, American warship, which was bombed in a harbour in Yemen. Now, what was used was a semi-inflatable packed with explosives, which was driven alongside the ship. Now, if I just highlight the hole in the side of the vessel. Now, this is a warship designed to withstand the impact of torpedoes, shells, or missiles, and you can see the damage that is done. If you could imagine the same scenario happening with an Atlantic Osprey, which is a single-hulled cargo ship, that there'd be a much more severe impact. Plus, as the explosion goes in the way, you'd have shards of metal being fired into the container hold. And I'd like to take this scenario to where we are now. This is obviously a map of the Baltic. Now, the shipments coming from Selfie to Sweden will have to pass through the Copenhagen Straits, which we have on here. And if I just zoom in a little bit, you can just see how really narrow these straits are. Now, if you imagine the scenario where the vessel's coming through here, a couple of coordinated attacks from two boats carrying explosives, there is no way that any land-based forces could get to that ship in time. A worst-case scenario is that a hole is blown in the side of the vessel, you have a breach of the flask followed by a fire which oxidizes some of the fuel, releasing the radiological pollution into the atmosphere, and then the vessel sinks in the channel. So not only do you have Helsingør, Helsingborg, Copenhagen and Malmo, all within this vicinity with a huge population, so you would have a really serious impact on the health and the environment. That you would have a huge worldwide incident with the world's press descending, damaging the reputation of the area. Even if you had no breach of the cask, you would still block the Copenhagen Straits, which is one of the new motorways of the sea. If you see here, this is 1 year's traffic. Nearly 40,000 vessels travel through that area. And in fact, if you blocked it for just 2 weeks, you would have a backlog of 1,400 vessels waiting to enter in and out of the Baltic, adding to the confusion and possible having other collisions and other pollution as a result. Now, you would think that in following that scenario that these ships would be escorted by the military, but they're not. And in fact, when BNFL were questioned, they said there was no need for an escort because the land-based response times were so quick within Europe. But when asked what the response time was, they couldn't answer. What we would suggest is that if the UK or BNFL isn't willing to provide an escort, the countries along the route should be escorting this vessel through their exclusive economic zone themselves to provide the protection for their coastal municipalities. Now, given the scenario, you'd think that contingency planning for a nuclear accident would be fairly high in the national plans for the countries. As I'm from the UK, I'm taking the example of the UK National Contingency Plan here. This is a large 158-page document, and I usually don't put a lot of text on my slide, but in this case I did, because this is the entire reference to nuclear materials in that 158-page document, two paragraphs. So it was in this background that last year at the North Sea Ministers' meeting on shipping and fisheries, that Kimo brought forward this text, which is fairly straightforward: ensure the best available technology is used in the case of the Pintail or the Teal, to review national contingency plans, to make sure that the vessels are escorted through each country's EEZs, and to revise national security plans, which all seem fairly logical steps. But the UK government said that if the reference to national security plans was continued, they would pull out of the whole Gothenburg Declaration on all issues, because it was a red flag issue. They could not discuss national security. So this text was thrown out. Now, Kimo's position is that ultimately we'd like to see no transport by sea and that waste should be stored on site. But obviously we're also realists and that that's not going to happen overnight. But what I'm calling on the Swedish NGOs here is to help put pressure on the Swedish government and regulators that they should stipulate to the UK what standard they expect their MOX fuel to be shipped in, and not leave that standards up to the UK who's shipping it across, and demand that there is military escorts and that they use the best available technology. And that's it. Thank you.
You mentioned that the ship was used for transports to Switzerland, and A's question is, where was it? Was it transported by some other means, or was it through the waterways of Europe?
No, it was transported from Sellafield to Cherbourg in France, and from there it went by rail, I think, to Switzerland.
I have a comment to John and a question to Anthony, if he's still here. Is he? A question to Anthony about his presentation.
Yes,
okay, my comment to John is that it was a really good presentation. And I just want to make a small tribute to, I think, someone who many of us know, Paul Leventhal, who died earlier this month, who I think made a huge contribution to the kind of work that John has presented here about the dangers of international transports of fissile materials, particularly plutonium, and the whole issue of the importance of having military escorts, of having armed ships, and so on. He did the pioneering work on that, particularly in respect of shipments through the Panama Canal and also around to Japan. So I just wanted to mention that, because Paul was a good friend of mine, and I think we're all going to miss him working in this field.
Absolutely.
A question to Anthony was, to pick him up on a point that he made, which I actually disagree with him on, and I wonder whether it can raise a more broad question in the meeting. I think there is a part of the Euratom Treaty that can be used to focus on environmental problems, particularly where there are developments within one EU member state that could have an impact on another member state. And in that context, Article 34 of the Euratom Treaty talks about if a member state wants to carry out what it describes as a particularly dangerous experiment, it should inform any other member states that might be impacted by such an experiment, and there should be some kind of agreement between them as to whether that experiment should go ahead. Now, in the context of that, I wonder whether this proposal to, you know, make Studsvik into some kind of new international center for metals processing and, you know, to increase the pollution into the Baltic as a result could be deemed by some of the other EU member states on the Baltic as a particularly dangerous experiment that they're going to carry out. And I wonder whether they could make an objection under Article 34 and see whether they can, you know, make some difficulties for Studvik's operators in the context of Article 34.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I mean, I don't know, Simon, do you know?
Can I ask my question at the same time as well? On Article 34, Article 34 is, as David said, it's part of the Euratom Treaty. refers to prior to undertaking particularly dangerous experiments, there is a process of, I forget the exact wording because it's a few years since I looked at it, but it's providing information and an opportunity to comment on it. To my knowledge, it's only been invoked once, or an attempt to invoke it was once, and that was in the context of nuclear weapons testing by France, because where France was doing the tests was actually covered by the Euratom Treaty for historical reasons. The scope of that, though, I think it would be fair to say, would be more in terms of health and safety rather than protection of the environment. Having said that, there's also another article which provides to measuring or monitoring of radioactive releases to the environment. But again, it's from a health and safety point of view, not from an environmental protection point of view. And lastly, the extent to which uratom can be used to address environmental questions is still pretty up in the air. There is one line of argument within the Commission that, taking into account developments in the Union since uratom was signed, that environmental considerations should be addressed. And there's another saying, no, that should only happen outside of the context of uratom. It's not sure which way it will end. So I don't know. I think it's, in any case, the Article 34 reference to particularly dangerous experiments should be interpreted narrowly, in my opinion. While I've got the floor, I had a comment to Anthony on the use or misuse of the decommissioning funds. And it occurred to me when I was listening to your presentation that there was quite a debate, particularly in Europe, about 5 to 10 years ago about the misuse of pension funds, where particularly state-owned enterprises were collecting enormous pension funds that were meant to be provided for their employees on retirement, and that these were used for investments as well. And there were quite strong rules put in place afterwards to ensure that such pension funds would actually exist in reality. And it may be something worth looking to in respect to the decommissioning funds as a parallel, not as a legal precedent.
Just on that, there's in the paper that is sort of the main text of my presentation, there's a footnote that is a big study on decommissioning that we did as part of a joint study on looking at decommissioning across the EU. And in that, it has recommendations on how to look after decommissioning funds. And part of that is based on the pension fund. So it's been looked at.
I'd like to come back to Simon Carroll's comment and my suggestion. I think Simon is right. I mean, he's definitely right that the only known time where Article 34 was invoked was to see whether or not France's nuclear testing could be disrupted because it might have impacted on Pitcairn Island, which was a British protectorate going back to the colonial days. So it was a kind of technical legal argument, which quite a few people looked into. But the reason why I mentioned it was because there's another article, Article 37, which is one to do with any country which is planning to discharge radioactive effluent to the seas. It's supposed to make a plan and inform the Commission about what it's planning to do. And the Commission publishes a statement in the official journal, normally saying it totally approves of it and go ahead and do it. So the experience of Article 37 is it's not going to be a particularly useful thing to do because the Commission will just endorse it. But Article 34 is different. It gives a bit of creativity and inventiveness to what is an experiment, how far is it particularly dangerous, and whether or not you can convince the lawyers for a neighboring state in the Baltics to say that they could actually do something useful with it. They thought they did want to stop something happening in Studsvik. So I think it gives an opportunity that hasn't been tried. And, you know, it would need some smart legal people who really can work on the way that uratom legislation works. But that's why I raised it rather than the Article 37, which I don't think would work.
I want to ask John about this lack of standards on the shipment of MOX. Since that's coming to Sweden, right? Couldn't a movement in Sweden or a protest from the Swedish side have an influence on the outcome of this? Or is it already unilaterally decided?
Are you Are we talking about the quality of the flasks or the ships?
Well, the ship, the security of the ship itself.
It's already been decided by the BNFL, and obviously it's under the IAEA regulations that they've set. So,
would it make any difference if the Swedish government was to launch a protest about the lack of security?
It would certainly would help. They should be demanding a higher level of security. I mean, it's passing straight past most of their coastline, so it's in their own interest to make sure that the highest possible standards are applied.
In the United States, there's a company that started out kind of little, and Energy Solutions, and one of the industries that I thought they bought was British nuclear fuels, and I don't know if Anthony's who's going to need to answer, and so they're already chatting. it was just a question on corporate buyouts. Is there just a portion of British nuclear fuel that was bought out by Energy Solutions? Do you know this stuff? How the different companies are buying each other out and who's got who they're licensed by? Do you have any?
I'm not so sure about the whole British nuclear group. Maybe David can do that. I mean, I'd know more about the different energy companies, and that if you look at that in terms of the market concentration issue is fascinating, because you have the three companies, E.ON, RWE, EDF, are just so far ahead of in terms of their corporate size than the fourth. They're basically RWE is now double the size of the fourth largest utility in Europe. So they just really have the use of the decommissioning funds has made a huge difference to their corporate buyouts over the last 5 years, basically. But maybe David could talk about who owns which in the British nuclear groups.
Yeah, I think at the moment the situation is a bit fluid. Two American companies, Washington Group and Fluor, want to buy different parts of BNFL. British government, as I mentioned when I gave my talk, BNFL used to be the big mega government-owned corporation that ran Sellafield and a number of other production reactors and some commercial or civilian reactors. I'm not sure how commercial they were. And when they created the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, the management of the facilities remained with British Nuclear Fuels, but the ownership went to the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. And that they promised British Nuclear Fuels they'd have the management contract for 5 years, and then they'd put it up for tender. So they had to demonstrate they were competent for 5 years to run the plants. And then they broke up British Nuclear Fuels itself into a number of other sub-companies. And some of these sub-companies are now being touted for being sold on the market, including the decommissioning part of British Nuclear Group. So there's now British Nuclear Group Sellafield Limited, and then it's British Nuclear Group Decommissioning, and so on. So two of the American companies are interested in buying the decommissioning one, and the trades unions are very opposed to these American buyouts because they don't trust American safety standards, having seen the way they've run our nuclear submarine bases and our nuclear weapons production sites. So there's a there's a dispute over that. And at the moment, as far as I know, they haven't sold any of them totally, but they may be in the process of selling them.
The one I was thinking of is a portion of British Nuclear Fuels that had the reprocessing technology, because Energy Solutions, which purchased that, is applying for three or four of the possible options in the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. It's our way of trying to fulfill Alberide's idea to have one country or a couple of countries do all the enrichment and reprocessing for everybody else. And so they're wanting to do that, and they're doing it with the British reprocessing technology, supposedly. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but I just wondered if I could clarify that, if anybody knew about it.
I mean, I can't take that point any further. I just wanted to put one thing on the record, because I think the meeting might find it both alarming and amusing. I mentioned yesterday that the Sellafield Thor plant, the reprocessing plant, had been shut down for 2 years because of an accident. And British Nuclear Fuels published on its website, it's very unusual for them, they published their internal safety report of the accident. And a lot of it was talking about how they were going to make things better and how they were going to convince the nuclear safety regulator to get their license back to operate the plant. And as we mentioned yesterday, or maybe today, I can't remember, today I think, they're just about in a position where they might be able to restart the plant, but they haven't done so yet. However, this is what they said in their own internal report about their own ability to operate this plant. They say, this event has demonstrated that despite high-quality construction, serious faults can occur within Thorpe, which breach primary containment. Given the history of such events so far, it seems likely that there will remain a significant chance of further plant failures occurring in the future, and this is the interesting part, even with the comprehensive implementation of the recommendations of this report. So they're basically telling the world in their own document that they still think they're going to have an accident in this plant, even if they do everything they're told to do to make it safe. So those people who think that plant's going to make lots of money for British Nuclear Group or some American buyer, I doubt it.
This is just a follow-up to my previous question. It occurs to me that this shipment of MOX that John was talking about is really testing the waters to see, literally, to see whether they can get away with cheaper, less expensive, less high-profile shipments of MOX as a precedent for future shipments. And I think that it would be really important for Baltic countries to protest loudly to the IAEA and to Britain over this. Make a fuss about it, because it may set a precedent for the future, and also it poses an immediate problem for the Baltic area.